behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben, and as always, we are joined by our super producer, Noel the Motorcade Brown. And today, we are doing a podcast that was a long time in coming. Isn't that right, Scott?
Yeah, a long time. And, you know, I've got to hand it to this listener for being absurdly patient with us.
So patient.
And honestly, Ben, I would have probably lost a little bit of patience as well after all that was going on. Because I was writing back and forth with this person. And it's Jason Morgan. And I'm saying his full name because we use Facebook. You know, he's on our Facebook page and everybody can see that there anyways. So Jason wrote in and said, let's see, the first message was from back in April of this year. And he says, I listened to your episode about the Cannonball Run and I really enjoyed it. And I think maybe he was talking about that that cross-country record that was made.
Uh-huh.
Because I don't know if we've done an actual Cannonball Run episode, have we?
Or
the Gumball Rally or one of those.
We've done Gumball.
Anyways, it was a fast drive across the United States.
Yeah,
really, is what it comes down to. And he said it made me think of this book, and it's called Against the Clock, The Incredible Story of the 749. That's 49 states in 7 days on a motorcycle. And there's a book by Ron Ayers, and there's also another book by Ron Ayers called Against the Wind, and Jason sent that book to us through the mail, and we received it a long, long time ago. I have since read the book, not every single page, most pages, because a lot of these pages are full of stats and facts and figures and things like that are specific to the race that the author participated in 1995. So anyways, thank you for sending the book. I think we've already thanked him for that in the past, but I asked him if he ever participates in this thing because I was curious about that. You know, you think you have a lot of interest in this, and he says, no, it's a dream that I have that probably will never happen. And we didn't know what it was all about at this point. He says, but my wife and I follow it closely every other year when it happens, so I was intrigued by that.
Yeah.
He says, I'm acquainted with a guy nearby who's done it a couple of times, though, and he says it's like the Olympics of long-distance motorcycling. And then, you know, that's when the book came in the mail. And I started to really kind of brush up on what this was all about. And it's a fascinating race, really. Oh, right. You know what? I shouldn't say race. It's not a race.
It's not a race. Right. It's a rally. We need to talk about a couple of things. First, we need to talk about the Iron Butt Association, right?
Sure.
So the Iron Butt Association has over 50,000 members, you guys. This thing is huge. And it is dedicated to safe, long-distance motorcycle riding. It's based in the U.S., but they have members across the planet.
Sure. Yep. And these guys are well-seasoned riders, of course. It's difficult to get into this association. And we'll tell you about the specific requirements for this later. And I think this may be something that we just point you to a website for you to look up exactly what it requires in order to gain entrance into specific races, because it varies between, I keep saying races. I hope I don't do that through the whole podcast. Events. Sure. These aren't races. That's something they stress on their site. But we'll refer you to the right pages to get all the information about this, because we'll do our best. But as usual, or as always, there's far more information here than we can ever cover during our podcast.
For sure. Well, let's paint the picture with the Iron Butt Association before we get to the Iron Butt Rally.
Sure.
Okay. So, as we said, over 50,000, maybe over 60,000 members, but the IBA, or Iron Butt Association, doesn't really have members in the traditional sense. You don't have to go to formal meetings. There's not like a newsletter or mandatory dues, although you have the option to pay dues and, you know, become like I think they call it a premier member.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's a little bit of an upgrade. They're often thought of or describe themselves as the world's toughest riders. And you can think that, like, that's pretty clear from Iron Butt Rally and the fact that it's motorcycle marathon, riding events.
Yeah, sure. Endurance riding for motorcycles. And, that is a completely different ball game than endurance racing for cars.
Mm-hmm. And if you pay this optional fee, then you get some news and info from the staff, early notice of some events. You get chances to enter some stuff, and we'll talk about how you enter things, discounted entry fees, and sometimes, you know, like access to special you know, special things, a couple goodies.
Sure.
So this is an organization that describes itself as loose-knit, and there is only one way to earn membership.
How's that?
You have to ride an IBA-certified ride.
Sure.
So to be in the event.
All these events. Now, so we're clear on this, the Iron Butt Rally is one rally that they hold. It's the most intense rally that they hold,
right.
Really.
But
the other events that lead up to this are the ones that you can participate in to gain certification to be allowed to even have a chance to participate in the
right.
Iron Butt Rally. They kind of run the gamut. There's a whole big list of them, and if you don't mind, I will go through just a few of these.
Yeah. Start at the easiest.
Well, okay. Here's the easiest one. The shortest one is called the Saddle Sore 1000. And this is a 24-hour, 1,000-mile ride on a motorcycle. Now, that's a long distance to cover
right.
on a motorcycle, right? Mm-hmm. That's got to be difficult. It's kind of tough, really, to drive a car 1,000 miles without being, getting sore, getting, the feeling like you want to get out, stretch your legs, stop for a while, pull over, take a rest, take a nap.
1,600 kilometers
a meal.
In 24 hours or less.
Yeah, something like that. It's a lot. And then it goes on from there. I mean, there's the Bun Burner 1500, which is 1,500 miles in 36 hours. And then there's the Bun Burner Gold, which is 1,500 miles in 24 hours, so a shorter time. There's the 50cc Quest, and that is a cross-country trip in 50 hours or less. That's pretty intense as well.
Yeah.
There's the National Parks Tourmaster Traveler Award, and this is kind of cool. You visit 50 parks in at least 25 states. There's no time limit on that one listed, but I'm sure that there's got to be some type of time restriction. There's the coveted 10-10th Challenge, which is 10 consecutive 1,000-mile days. So you're getting the idea that these are getting more and more difficult, right? And then there's... This one is not really a rally. This is something different. This is a certification, but you can get something called you can enter into the 100,000 mile club. And the 100,000 mile club is exactly what it sounds like, but you're restricted to 1 year. And you have to have a well-documented ride, that lasts 1 year, 100,000 miles. You have to have a certified 100,000 miles. Now, I was doing a little bit of the number crunching with this, and it comes out to, if you ride 7 days a week, it's slightly less than 300 miles a day. A day, every day for 7 days a week. Now, if you want to condense that into 5 days, you can just do the math and figure this out.
Right, right. Take Saturdays and Sundays off.
And by well documented, you can't be missing one gasoline receipt. You can't, there's photo proof that's required for this. There's restrictions. There's, official procedures that you have to go about in order to have this verified. But it is a very difficult club, I guess, to get into. And, aside from that, those other rallies we mentioned, the Iron Butt Rally is even more difficult than, that 10-10th challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Iron Butt Rally is held in the U.S. every 2 years. It first ran in 84, and it started from the Montgomeryville Cycle Center, and that's just outside of Philly, right?
Yeah, and this is where it differs, Ben, because when it started in 84, it was run every year for a short amount of time.
Right.
When in 84, 85, 86, and 87... And then it skipped ahead, then it was not run. It skipped ahead to 1991, and that's when the Iron Butt Association came about, when they kind of took over the ride, overseeing the ride, I guess. That's maybe
right.
a better way to say it. And the sanctioning body. And so now that the Iron Butt Association runs it, they run every other year, as you said.
Yeah, usually in August. Here's the current state of the Iron Butt Rally. It lasts 11 days. Riders often travel over 11,000 miles in that time. You earn points by riding your motorcycle to various bonus locations in Canada and in the U.S. So a bonus, they might have just a destination, or they might have a task that you have to do, and these different things have a point value.
Sure. I can give you some examples of these
if you'd
like.
Yeah,
that'd be great. All right, so, but one thing I want to clarify here is that, and before we just kind of gloss over this point, before we go into the bonuses, you read that right. It's 11 days, and it's like 11 consecutive 1,000-mile days on a motorcycle. Now, a lot of people, when they take on this challenge, they feel like their main goal is just to finish this rally. It's not
right.
so much to win or place very high. Or
get bonuses.
Yeah, there's certifications that you get from getting these bonuses, so that puts you into different levels of competition, I guess, where you can finish in gold position or you know, silver or bronze, based on the points that you collect from these things. And we'll describe that in a second. But again, a lot of people just want to finish the thing. That's their goal. And whether it's, you know, restrictions, of the human body, I guess, you know, you just can't take it. You physically can't, you know, manage this. Or if it's mechanical, because a lot of people have mechanical failure along the way that puts them out of this competition. Because it's very difficult to keep a bike running in all the different weather conditions that are present. Because they deal with everything from Death Valley at the heat of the day. I mean, like the highest point, hottest point, up to, you know, snow covered mountain peaks. And everything in between, and, you know, rain, they said there's even been an occasional tornado that they've had to deal with, you know, passing the, you know, crossing the path of the rally. It's a really fascinating event when you start to dig into it and you start to really think about what that's like to spend all that time sitting on a motorcycle seat. I mean, I gotta be honest, Ben, I think, and I'm not a rider. I never have been a motorcycle rider, but. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine what it would be like to get onto the bike that second day. The first day, I guess I can kind of see. You can push through just about anything. You can probably make it. I mean, it's got to be tough, and it gets cold or whatever. That sure. adds to it. But the second day and the third day and the fourth day, and then you realize, well, you're not even halfway through this whole thing by the fourth day. And you got to just keep going, going, going. And that's how it all works.
And even if you finish, right, you may not technically qualify because in order to be considered a finisher of the Iron Butt Rally, you have to be present at each of these checkpoints they have set up at a specific time window.
Sure. Yeah.
And you have to have a minimum number of bonuses during that rally. So you have to have like, you know, there's an entry level thing, and usually these bonuses, you have to prove that you were there by taking a picture of the place or like purchasing something.
Well, and it's very specific about it too, about each checkpoint. So they may give you a very exact set of items that have to appear in that picture with you. I mean, they give you a rally towel, you know, that you have to have that has the, something, you know, a numbered towel.
Sure. Something specific for that year.
Yeah, you wouldn't have it ahead of time, you know, ahead of the rally, so you couldn't, fake these pictures in any way. They say that you have to have it, with this person at this landmark or, you know, whatever. It's something they set up ahead of time.
But,
I think one of the bonus places was like, you gotta find the burnt remains of the, Branch Davidian Ranch and,
out there in Waco.
Yeah, the compound in Waco. And, you have to stop off at the LA County Morgue and buy a toe tag from them and have, you know, a certain person sign it or something.
Can you imagine working at the morgue and thinking, oh God, here we go.
Well, you know, they kind of, I mean, they sign on for something like that.
Yeah.
They say like, yeah, sure, we'll do that.
It's probably, it's not a surprise.
Well, here's just one example. Now this is coming from the book that, Jason sent us. It's called Against the Wind by Ron Ayers.
Right. And, probably the best book available on the rally.
Oh, definitely is. Yeah. I mean, I was reading through it. It's fascinating stuff. It's really kind of cool to read about. But this just gives you an idea for the bonus locations. And this was in 1995. The first leg of this trip was from, they started out in Salt Lake City and they went to Spokane, Washington. Now, just looking at the numbers on this, I mean, it takes, I looked it up on, you know, Google and found out that it's 10 hours to drive straight through from Salt Lake City to Spokane, Washington. It's just a 10-hour straight drive. They give the riders 23 hours to cover that distance. So, here's the thing. They leave at, 4 p.m. on the day of the rally starts. They have to be at the next checkpoint by, they say that the window opens at the final checkpoint, at 3 p.m. the very next day. And it's open for a 2-hour window. And you've got just that 2-hour window to collect your 2,000 bonus points for getting to that checkpoint. So 2,000 points are up for grabs right there. And every rider knows that they have to be there within those 2 hours. So what you do then is you have to strategically plan based on this list that they give you where you can get to get these bonus points. Like just for example, and this one, I'll tell you one that's statistically impossible in just a moment, but the first realistic bonus point that you could get would be Chimney Rock historical site in Nebraska. And you can collect 315 points for getting to that point. And then it goes down to, you can go to Las Vegas, Nevada for 286 points and so on down the list, right? And a lot of these are airports or state parks or things like that, you know, places that are easy to prove that you were there. I mean, you could take a photograph that, and for each one, they tell you where you have to go in there. Like, it's not just go to Las Vegas and get a sign out, a photo of you near the sign or something like that. It's like you have to go there and go to Harrah's Casino and take a photo in front of the biggest slot machine in the front of the, you know, whatever the specific
and,
is.
And additionally, each year they might have a theme, right? So, so 1 year, 2007 would be about gateways and arches. So the bonus photos and stuff were related to those themes. And of course, our favorite, 2009, crime scenes.
Oh, yeah, that's cool. That's, so they've got a theme for each event and mm-hmm. it follows along that theme. This one was, it seems like this was, National Monuments and National Parks for 1995 then. Here's the one that's impossible, Ben. If you decided to take a side trip to go to Anchorage, Alaska, you could gain 963 points. That's,
wow.
That's huge. But then you find out that just from the finishing point in Spokane, it's 45 hours on the Alaskan highway.
So there's no way.
No. It's like 2,400 miles one way. There's no way you're going to be able to make that. So Anchorage is way, way up in Alaska. It's not like you're not down at the bottom of it or anything. So it's impossible to do it, really. Because you would then forfeit the points for the Spokane checkpoint, and that would be losing 2,000 points right off the bat. And the other thing about that is that if you don't arrive within the window, you know, between 3 p.m. and 5 p.m. the next day, you're penalized. And this varies by location, but the penalty for arriving late to this specific one was 1 point per minute is what you forfeit.
Whoa, that adds up quickly.
Yeah, it does. And then later on, you'll see that there are some points that, you know, they may only have a one-hour open window that you have to arrive, and you lose 5 points per minute for being late to that one. So you're strictly tied to that. However, they want, throughout this book, they continually reinforce the idea that it's not a race.
Right.
You can travel the speed limit and get there at the set time. You have to determine how to do that safely, and gain as many of these bonus points as you can along the way. And it's funny when I read this book, because it's from the 1995 rally.
Right.
GPS really wasn't a thing. There was one guy in this book that had kind of rigged up a GPS system. He was a software engineer, I think.
Uh-huh.
He had his own kind of crude GPS system that he was using to aid him along the way. So he wasn't having to read the maps like everybody else. But even then, his software that he was using didn't recognize all the points. It wasn't advanced like what we have now, where you can just plug in just about anything and it'll take you there.
Right.
These guys were using paper maps or maps that were provided by AAA, they stopped off to get, and having to read them on the road. And you know, the first time that they would see these roads is when they were on them, so they didn't know where they were going.
Well, that's a good point, Scott, because we should underline this. The riders only know the bonuses for the leg they're currently on, which, of course, affects the way you're planning stuff sometimes,
sure,
right?
They hand them a packet, right?
And there are far more bonuses than can be completed. Like, it's designed so that you cannot do all the bonuses in one leg, normally.
No, so you have to quickly, very quickly,
right,
determine what's possible, what's not possible, and what you're going to go for. And this is really, you know, a true test of your endurance.
Mm-hmm.
This is like, well, how much do I really want to push this? So I want to just try to get into the general area of Spokane for this first leg and then, gather what I can. But see, let's say that you're leaving Salt Lake City. If you're going to head to Las Vegas, right away you got to start heading away from your final destination. So you got to decide, yeah, I'm going to head south. I'm going to head southwest instead of going northwest at this point.
Yeah.
And you got to determine that right as you leave at 4 o'clock. And once you commit to it, I think you're pretty much set to do that. I mean, it's not like you can get halfway to Las Vegas and decide this was a mistake. I'm going to turn around because
sunk cost.
You've exactly right. You've given it up at that point. So it's really an interesting strategic game that they play.
Oh, we didn't even talk about how hard it is to get into the actual Iron Butt Rally.
Yeah, we said that, you know, you have to be certified or
you have to be a member.
A member. And by member, it means you have to complete one of their other events. And it has to be one of the ones that they deem appropriate to qualify you
for
the
Iron
Butt Rally.
They have some that won't cut it.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to select one that, and again, contact the association ahead of time. If you're really planning to do something like this, make sure you're entering the right one to qualify you for the next one.
Right.
And it's critical to do stuff like that. But once you have that certification, even then, it's a little bit difficult to get into. Now, in the early years, back in the 1980s, you know, up until, you know, 1987 or whenever they stopped running.
Right.
It was just maybe a few dozen riders. It was like a just relatively unknown event at the time.
Sure.
And now, they have to limit the event to 125 riders. and it is chosen. There's a few hand-selected people that are allowed into the event, and these are the guys that they call the big dogs, the ones that enter a lot of these endurance rally events, and they typically place very well. They've got a lot of experience. It's good for the sport, I guess, to have them in there. The big names that garner the attention and all that. And they all become kind of a tight-knit club at some point. And, those very few positions are picked, hand-picked by the president of the IBA. Mm-hmm. And then from there, there's a lot of leftover openings, I guess. And,
sure.
And those are picked via lottery.
Ah, yes, the lottery. I think this is ingenious, Scott. This seems to me a fair way to do it and a fair way to load the odds as well. So it's by lottery only. Every lottery entry must be from an Iron Butt member, right? So you have to be a member first. People who are working the rally and supporters, as well as those premier folks who pay a little extra annual fee, they're given an extra chance in the lottery process. And that's because there are different pools from which these folks are drawn, right? So volunteers, veterans, and premier members they're grouped into their own pool, and then a certain amount of numbers are drawn first from there. And then if you don't win that time, you go into the general population pool.
Oh, okay.
So I think that's a neat way to give somebody an extra chance or a little bit of reward for being, a veteran or volunteering to work the rally or, supporting the association through being a paying member.
That's a very clever way to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
I think I could see it working. I can't, imagine, I don't have anything that anybody would want to play a lottery for.
Yeah, well,
but if so, that's how I would do it.
There's going to be so much we want to talk about. I was kind of thinking about talking about the standings for 2015, but I think that maybe just rather than read a list of names, I just want to tell you kind of an idea of how things kind of sort out here.
Sure.
The first, I'm not going to read all of them by any means. There's a huge long list of them here, but the winner's name was Eric Jewell. And Eric Jewell for 2015 had a total score of 106,653. Now, that means that he visited 108 national parks during this event. Now, 108, he went through 25 states, so it didn't hit all the states, 25 states. Total number of miles ridden, 11,087 miles, and that's in 11 days. So that's a pretty intense ride, right? But that's not the most miles ridden by any of the competitors. If you go down to the guy that plays 25th, he rode 12,900 miles, and his score was only 75,000 points. So it shows you, and he visited 54 parks and hit 27 states. So he rode a longer distance. He just didn't get the bonuses that had the higher points. And this, the numbers become kind of fascinating to look at. You do get kind of stuck on that. Well, that's interesting how that works, that he could visit half the number of parks, yet ride, significant distance long, greater. It's just really interesting. And here's one that rode 8,888 miles. And, positioned 28th, so just below the guy that rode 12,900 miles, almost 13,000 miles. I love looking at the numbers from stuff like this.
Yeah, well, it shows even more so the strategy inherent in there. When you're playing this, it does become a numbers game in addition to an endurance game, right?
Sure, yeah.
Which is why they can't really tell somebody all of the bonus things for all of the legs at once, because then you can calculate the winning score.
That's true, the optimal route. Yeah, you're right. And then, all the people that are required to check all this stuff, with the photographs and the receipts and all that.
Right.
They say that, if you lose one gas receipt along the way, that's not necessarily something that's going to disqualify you from the ride, but if it's happening day after day, I think something, and they do odometer checks, and they do, it's all very regulated. It's all, you have the burden of proof on your back when you're doing this as well. You have to be able to show that you were somewhere, whether that's toll receipts or, photographs or, fuel receipts, whatever it happens to be.
Yeah.
You have to prove exactly where you were and when to show that, this is a legit reading on your odometer. And, Ben, I don't want to let this podcast get away without mentioning one thing that's on the IBA site. It's actually, it's from ironbutt.com.
Oh, I think I know what you're going to say.
What do you think I'm going to say? Just curious.
Archives of Wisdom?
Yes, you got it right. That's I knew we were thinking on the same page here. There is a place on the on ironbutt.com. It's under, I believe it's under the Tech House tab.
Yeah.
And it's called the Archive of Wisdom. Now, the Archive of Wisdom is exactly what it sounds like, but right now it's got 28 tips and techniques from IBR veterans. So all these Iron Butt Rally competitors that have years and years, some of them decades of experience,
right,
that go into this, and they tell you some really valuable information. Like and it's short. You know, you can look at these, and they're not extremely lengthy descriptions of you know what to do and what not to do. But you know, they'll tell you like forget about high speeds.
Right. Oh, can we read a bit from that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Forget what you've been told. High speeds and long distance riding have little in common. A steady rider can book more miles, enjoy more mountain vistas, and ride more twisty miles than a canyon carver bent on making the best times across a mountain pass. Besides the obvious effects on fuel mileage, which means more time wasted looking for gas, and the fatigue caused by fighting the effects of pushing a motorcycle through the wind, riding much beyond the flow of traffic will land you a hefty speeding ticket. While you are on the side of the road having a spirited discussion with a police officer about your 10/10 riding style, the turtle-like rider on that Honda 250 will wave as he sets himself up for the next set of corners.
Yeah, see, and that's about one of the longer entries in this whole thing. So you can go through this entire list and gain these little nuggets of wisdom from people that have done this. Like, here's one that says use an electric vest. And it says even on the warmest summer nights, after a few days of 100 plus temperatures, a 75 degree evening ride can send a chill through your bones. So, especially when you're it's a cool, wet evening. That makes it even worse. And I know a lot of riders already know this stuff, but then you got to remember, what's that going to be like when I'm trying to ride another 12 hours in that damp rain gear that's going to be impossible. I love the way they've just kind of boiled this down to the essentials here. Eliminate all distractions and irritants.
Avoid boredom.
Yeah. Carry a flat repair kit and know how to use it. Upgrade your toolkit. That's an excellent one. Actually, the toolkit thing, I think that may be a little longer only because it lists specifically what this veteran to this event carries in his tool bag. And some of the things in here, it's amazing. It sounds like an awful lot, and then he tells you the size of the bag that it fits in.
Yeah.
You wouldn't believe it. It's very small, very compact, but what he's got there is probably, it seems like the contents of my garage at home. It seems like a lot. I mean, and it's really, really smart things, too.
Right.
Like, you know, bring a Swiss Army knife.
Voltometer.
A digital tire gauge and spare keys for everything because you never know when you're going to lose a key.
Right.
Spare fuses for everything.
A magnet, just in general.
6 feet of siphon hose.
Mm-hmm.
Just really clever things. You know, a certain length of rope. Magnifying glasses.
Zip
ties.
Just
so many. A digital multimeter. There's a lot here. And really, you know, going from the wisdom of the elders, I guess, is what you're doing at this point. It's fascinating to just kind of pick your way through this list. Know how to avoid boredom is a good one.
Yeah. So they have stuff like, having a tape player with your favorite music or, you know, a sound system. And then one of the other things I didn't think about was this idea of keeping a supply of some tart food or tart candy to give you that little zing. And they also say, this is interesting, but one of the first things in this Archive of Wisdom is to avoid drugs, including coffee.
Yeah, caffeine is kind of a no-no on this because you're artificially keeping yourself awake.
Right.
And they don't like that. They say, I mean, there's a lot in here about knowing your limits, about understanding what you're capable of. And that's how they have a great safety record as well. You'd think that all these motorcycle riders would be like zombies at the end. And, you know, while they're exhausted, I mean, just flat out exhausted, I believe they've never had like a serious injury where, you know, a rider in the event or, somebody outside the event that, you know, was in the wrong spot at the wrong time. I don't think they've had any deaths in this event ever. Surprisingly,
I couldn't find a record of any.
Surprisingly so. And you've got, you know, 100 plus motorcyclers out on the roads, traveling 1,000 miles a day for 11 days. That's pretty intense. And little tricks like that. I mean, they say if you think about closing your eyes for just 1 second, that means you're tired. Get off the road now. Right now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of little tips and things like that along the way. And I tell you, Ben, the most fascinating part of this whole topic to me is once I learned about it, when I just kind of sat back in my chair and was thinking about really, really doing this. Now, not that I'm going to do this by
sure.
any means. It's beyond me.
Maybe one day.
Well, I'm not even a motorcycle rider right now, so that'd be a big step. But when you really consider what this entails, what this challenge entails, this has got to be one of the most difficult things ever to accomplish. I mean, it really does. It's got to be. It's just an ultimate test of your endurance, your patience, your skill, your riding skills.
Yeah, your tenacity.
Yeah, your planning. The machine itself. You know,
the willpower.
Getting the bike ready. Yeah, the willpower. It's all this comes into play. It's when you start thinking about 20 hours a day on a motorcycle with, you know, you've got the helmet on, you've got, you know how that is. It's kind of like you got nothing but your own thoughts going through your head
mm-hmm.
all day long. It's got to seem like you're just in the most solitary position ever. But then again, you're part of this bigger rally where every evening you get together with the people that ride and there's that camaraderie as well. But the solitary nature of this whole thing, it's mind-boggling to me. Like, how can they do it? How do they possibly do this?
I would love it.
I think, you know, it'd be fun, but I think that after about the third or fourth day, I would just be too tired to go on. I mean, I feel, even if you were in a car, a nice big cushy car.
Right.
And you're driving 1,000 miles in, you know, 24 hours or whatever, and you have to do that day after day after day, that's really, really hard to do.
I'd like to hear from some of the people who have taken the opportunity to go on this rally or a similar rally on a bike. And for our non-US listeners, our non-Canadian listeners, if you are saying to yourself, man, I love this idea, but here I am in Europe or wherever, and I can't get over to the States for a race, you know, like my wife or husband would never let me do that because that's a weird thing to do. Well, we have good news. The Iron Butt Association does have an arm in the UK. It runs its own rally each year called the Brit Butt Rally.
Okay. Now, you know, one thing that they said early on in the information here was that the U.S. provides them with a unique opportunity. Outside of Australia, there's not really a place that doesn't have international borders like the U.S. It is a big mass of land
right.
that you're allowed to travel with all these different terrains and different climates.
Yeah, and you don't have to deal with the same border crossings.
Yeah, that's it. The border crossings, the international border crossings become a bit challenging for a rally because you can be hung up at those borders for a long, long time if
sure.
you don't have the right paperwork or you have to meet mm-hmm. certain standards, you know, for safety or whatever. So they say that, you know, outside the U.S., Australia is about the only other place like that. So I wonder how they operate this U.K. branch. How different the rally
yeah.
is and feel from, you know, the one that's run here in the U.S.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I'd like to hear more about that. Cool. Just on a side note, when you mentioned Australia, I watched Mad Max Fury Road again. And, you know, I have a copy now.
Yeah.
I think I've been watching it too often, man.
Why is that?
Well, it's affecting my driving.
Oh, no.
I'm not kidding.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm not kidding. I'm not driving like a jerk or a loon or something, but my tolerance, which was once upon a time pretty high, even when we were downtown in Buckhead, now my tolerance has like dwindled.
It's seriously dropped, huh?
I am judge and jury. I hope I don't become executioner,
no,
but
like
yeah,
I'm
serious.
Renegade out there.
So I figured out some different paths to take. And if you time them correctly through the city on these back roads, and if you time them correctly and the wind is at your back, then you can navigate around the city really well. But it got to the point where I realized that I have to either stop using my horn or change the sound of it.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
You know what? Oh, no. I don't even know if I've ever. Well, I did honk my horn. Remember I mentioned that one day I honked it
yeah.
near you.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get it to make a little beep beep sound. It was like more like a I'm angry sound.
It was like.
Yeah. Yeah. It was unfortunate. But I don't hardly ever use my horn. Yeah. Even if something's going wrong around me, it's not my instinct to go for the horn button.
See, there's this whole this is, I know, admittedly a different podcast, but there's this whole communication system that could be possible with a horn that manufacturers aren't really doing. You know, like there should be levels of honking, because right now what most people have is just a horn that allows maybe, let's say, three levels all based on the length of the honk, right? So tap or tap tap, that's a friendly watch out.
Well, that's what I was trying to do when I passed you. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the one short burst is the the stronger version.
Yeah.
Maybe the watch the beep out.
Hey, you know? I'm over here.
Right. And then the long blast is the, I will find you. That's how I think of it.
A little dark at the end there.
Yeah, yeah. I will
yeah,
find you.
Yeah, not like you. I thought you were going to say like you've really screwed up, but it's. I will find you.
That's to me. It's if I ever do that, then I'm memorizing the license plate at the same time.
You need some therapy.
You know, maybe I just need to lighten up on the Mad Max.
Maybe
watch Cannonball Run
something. You know, I wonder. I mean, I keep going back to this, but like when you take 5 minutes to really think about what it would be like to do this, this rally, to participate in this, there's so many angles to it. Like, how do you feel at the end of that? Do you feel like you own the road and everybody else should just get out of the way? Because you've got, I mean, in 11 days, you've covered a lot of terrain,
right?
And you've seen just about everything at that point. You must feel like it belongs to you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be kind of a weird feeling, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's strange, and it's also one of those things that you should be very proud of accomplishing, you know?
Yeah, it's a good point, Ben. I mean, it's like there's this group of people that already have kind of a rare set of circumstances around what they do. And then to finish or to participate in and even finish an Iron Butt rally out of that group of people— That's an even smaller group and more exclusive, I guess, in a way.
Right.
Yeah. So fascinating.
And it's a global group. People around the world are itching to go out on the rally. If you are one of the few who has successfully completed this, then we would love to hear from you. So you can check us out on our Facebook and Twitter. I'm just putting that in earlier in the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're CarStuffHSW. And just this is a side note. And I'm all about side notes. I've got one for you, though.
Sure.
Okay, remember earlier, my friend, when we talked in our two-part series on cars that didn't make it?
Yes.
We talked about the Dodge Diora?
Yes.
So I went on Twitter, and I said, hey, help me settle this bet with Scott. What do you think of the Dodge Diora? Butt ugly? Super cool? A lot of the responses were both.
Oh, no.
Both.
Yeah. You can't answer both to that. Come on. That is a chicken answer.
It's a chicken answer.
Yeah, I'm leaving out one word. Wow, that is something.
Well,
so how can you say both?
Somebody said, I call it, Coop said, I call it a little quirky and kind of kitschy cool. I dig it, daddy-o. Pete F. said, it is awesome. Sakon D said it looks like a boat that failed its boating test. I'm going past the people who said both.
That's some good ones. Some good responses anyways.
Yeah. So,
I still like it. I looked at it, probably not yesterday, but the day before, trying to find some photographs of it. And, I still like it.
And one more Twitter.
That's all there is to it.
One more Twitter thing though, Scott. Our listener, Stuart L. After hearing the podcast and Cars That Never Made It, he replied with, I think we can all agree that this is the car that should have definitely been made. And I think you'll recognize this one.
Oh, I like it. That's the Homer.
Yeah, the Homer.
The car designed by Homer Simpson.
Listeners, surely, I'm just going to assume that everybody knows about the Homer.
I think they have to at this point. It's used everywhere in memes and all kinds of stuff.
It's such a great idea.
Yeah, it really is. Perfect idea and flawless execution.
Yeah, well, what could go wrong? Well, anyhow, I just wanted to do a quick Twitter update there. If you guys have an opinion on the Dodge Diora, please let us know. You can write to us directly. You can hit us up on Twitter, where we are CarStuffHSW.
Well, yeah, and you know what? We should thank Jason one more time for sending that book.
That was so awesome.
Kind of, hipping us to this idea of these endurance motorcycle events, because I didn't know that this whole world was out there. And
It's
fascinating when you dig into it. The people that are involved, the machines that are involved, mm-hmm. the preparation that's required for them. It's amazing. So thank you, Jason, for sending the book and again, just giving us the idea to do this show. It was fun.
Yeah, we're pulling for you, man. We hope that you do get to the rally.
Yeah,
one
do it
day.
Someday. Do it someday.
All right. And with that, would you like to take a page from Jason M's book? Not the book he sent us. It's a figure of speech.
Oh, Ben.
Whatever. Okay. I'll keep going. If you want to write to us is what I'm trying to say, then, we'd love to hear from you. It can be an idea for an upcoming show. It can be a response to a previous topic, but whatever it is, you can write to us directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.